Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation. Welcome to another episode of Talking About Platforms. My name is Philip Meyer. Today with me, my co-host Tommaso Boganza. Hello, Tommaso.
Hi. Great to be here again.
And we have with us Shiva Shekhar, who is an assistant professor at the Tilburg School of Economics and Management in the Netherlands. He holds a PhD from the Düsseldorf Institute of Competition Economics, DICE, in Germany, and is doing lots of interesting research about platforms that we are talking about today. I'm super excited to have you. Welcome to Talking About Platforms, Shiva. Hi.
Hi, Philip. First of all, thank you for inviting me for this session. I look forward to our conversations. Yeah.
Great to have you.
Okay. So, first of all, it's great having you here. And we typically start every episode with mainly the same question. And the question is, so what are platforms to you? And also something more, you know, personal about you as not only as a researcher, but as a human being. How did you end up studying platforms? So how did it all begin?
Thank you, Tommaso. So maybe I'll start with the first question. I thought today this about what it means for me. So basically, it's a digital platform is a firm that employs kind of, you know, digital technologies or the technologies afforded by the internet, right, to enable interaction between different groups. Right. And that creates value for different people. Right. That's basically my understanding of platforms and to enable interactions and also, you know, kind of to optimize the value created for themselves as well. They use different techniques like prices. They use, you know, advertisement. They use different ways to attract consumers and different value creators. Right. Again, value creators and consumers is a very fluid term. It can mean, you know, for advertisers, consumers are value creators, vice versa, right? And with the availability of the means of collecting data and analyzing data, digital platforms are able to more precisely understand the value unit for each, you know, consumer interaction. And that is able to, you know, kind of create more optimal, you know, kind of value creation and enhancement, which was not possible before. Before, you were not able to perfectly offer the value units needed by somebody. You didn't understand it. You just offered a standard stuff, maybe a little bit of customization, but at the end, everything was standard. But now with data-enabled technologies, you're able to do that. So that is the next frontier of exciting, you know, things that are going to come up in platforms. Yeah. And the second question was, how did I get in? Actually, it was just by accident, I must admit. So I started, working during my PhD on supply chain economics, on vertical relations, what's going on. And then the first time I interacted properly with a platform apart from Facebook was Airbnb. So, you know, at that time in 2013 or 14, it was new for me and, you know, it was exciting. And I thought maybe that might be the future of, you know, kind of technology. Maybe let me start pivoting towards it. So I tried to see how I can use platform experience in supply chain economics towards platforms. That's how the first paper came out on superstar exclusivity. It's literally a supply chain paper in platform markets. So that's how, you know, kind of I leveraged some of my understanding of supply chain contracting onto platform markets. Yeah, that's how I moved towards platform. Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Thank you so much for also mentioning the superstar exclusivity topic, because Shiva, I would like to split this conversation today into two parts. The first one, I'd like to talk about exactly that topic, superstar exclusivity, what you understand about it, and why is it so, let's say, also important for a more practical audience to understand this in current times, in light of, for example, Microsoft and the Activision Blizzard acquisition as one of the, I think, core cases that is super current. And then the second one, and this is also something that's very dear to my heart, which is the role of hosting rivals and thinking about digital transformation. So a traditional firm becoming a platform and then making decisions about hosting rivals. So starting with superstar exclusivity, how would you define what a superstar complementer is, and mm-hmm. and how do you, let's say, frame this topic and your thinking, your mental model around the superstar exclusivity topic in the context of digital platforms?
First of all, thank you, Philip, for this question. And you know, let me start first with the superstar. So the idea of what we thought of superstar was what is the unique value of a superstar, or you know, unique proposition in the market or the ecosystem of a superstar in comparison to other creators, was that it had bargaining power with respect to the platform, right? And that's where it was able to dictate contracts to a platform and not vice versa. In most cases, what we saw was, you know, the platform just set a price and smaller developers or consumers just decided to enter the platform. While superstars were unique in the sense that they were able to dictate contracts. So that was a new, you know, set of, you know, kind of content creators that we observed, and we used that and we modeled it into our table. So we wanted to understand, how does this contracting scheme affect like superstar contracting scheme, which we observed very often in streaming markets, in, you know, gaming markets, in so many markets, right? And we try to ask, how does this impact, you know, kind of welfare? How does it impact, you know, competition? And we try to, you know, go into detail. But at the end, what matters is, like in every network market paper, what matters is how much can superstars create aggregation. I'll explain that concept in a bit. But that is it. And that's also the same in the other role of hosting rivals paper as well. So that's what I want to give the premise as. So let me start with kind of, you know, explaining what, you know, kind of what happens with exclusivity. So very often exclusivity is seen very negatively in, you know, competition economics. It's seen as something that's going to lead to monopolization and shutdown of competition and leading to, you know, bad outcomes. What we found in our paper, interestingly, was that exclusivity can lead to increase in welfare, despite that the smaller platform might be worse off. This simply because of the aggregation. So once a platform is able to win exclusive deals with a superstar, what it does is it allows for coordination of demand. More consumers come, then more smaller developers also come, and more developers coming, more consumers come. That leads to a classic network effects flywheel, which switches on, right? And if the value of this shift of consumers or the value of network effects between the sides is high enough, then the gain in value created from aggregation can dominate any losses that the other consumers on the other platform have. It's a simple idea, right? At the end, what matters is network effects is aggregation. And if aggregation is valued a lot, then it's better to have, you know, kind of exclusive deals. And that's what we show. And I think that's also very well, you know, kind of established. But in this context, it was new. Yeah. So that's what we did for the... And in addition, in going to the Microsoft Activision case, I wouldn't, you know, kind of directly comment that saying that our paper is perfectly aligned with that. Because, you know, there are many, you know, kind of differences, and, you know, people can misuse, you know, our paper, you know, to their benefits. So I just want to point out that in our setting, we found that if a superstar like for example, Superstar Studio or a game merges with a platform, it may be that the exclusive deals are less likely after the merger, which is counterintuitive in comparison to the case when, what do you say, when you look at traditional markets. Traditional markets, if a supplier and a retailer merge, then you know, the idea is foreclosure, vertical foreclosure. It means that once a supplier and retailer merge, the supplier-retailer entity, the merged entity, wants to shut down a potential competition in the market by not supplying an essential input, right? In our case, it's not the case because the Superstar is not an essentials provider. There is a vertically separate or differentiate, or no, horizontally differentiated platform that is offering some other service, right? And we're just showing that by the merger, what happens is that the platform internalizes the ancillary revenues offered by the, you know, kind of that the platform has, that the Superstar has. What this leads to is that the ancillary revenues, if they're internalized by the merged, you know, the platform entity, then it's going to be more aggressive because it wants to have more ancillary revenues as well, right? Because it's part of the platform's, you know, platform Superstar entity. So it's going to price lower. It's going to bring in more consumers. As a result, the profit of the rival platform is going to be low. Taking that into account, this means that, you know, kind of, if the merged entity offers a non-exclusive contract, it can extract all this additional surplus, which the Superstar could not have done beforehand. Because before the merger, the Superstar did not control the prices of the platform. Right. As a result, it led to the fact that we found it can be that non-exclusive contracts are more likely after a vertical merger between a platform and a Superstar than, what do you say, kind of before the merger. And this is counter to what is understood in traditional markets. Traditional markets, you want to shut down the rival and gain monopoly rights. Here, no, it's not necessarily. You want to have the rival because you know, you can extract more from the rival by, you know, offering non-exclusive deals. Yeah. This was the, you know, kind of the simple idea, and this is how it might fit in the Microsoft Activision case. But I must admit, there are many differences between what we have done and what the case is about. So yeah, this is basically it about the kind of, you know, the Superstars people. Going to... Yes, please.
But no, sorry, but I think it's super interesting, you know, for a couple of reasons. First, I think that Microsoft will be happy to hear this, because this is mainly their point. So there's no point for us to shut down, you know, other platforms. So once we buy Activision, we would just lose, you know, part of the market. There's no point on it. But I was wondering, because this idea of Superstar is very intriguing to me. And I don't know, I would like to know if you already thought about some possible variations about it. So the two things that I was thinking about are first. So you analyze the case of an existing Superstar. What is happening if the Superstar is raising on the platform? Because, I mean, in a certain way, you're not born a Superstar. So you need to grow up somewhere. So I don't know if you ever thought about it. So how would this change? Because probably some of the agreements, all of the agreements were done before you becoming a Superstar. So is it possible to change the game somehow? Maybe, you know, jumping on another platform and stuff like that. So this is the first. And then I got another one, but I'm very curious about this.
So this is a very good point. So in our case, we looked at the case, you know, that there are external Superstars who come and add value, right? For example, Beyonce or Taylor Swift, who literally, you know, kind of can bring in masses of consumers. They're filling stadiums, right? Smaller Superstars, you know, kind of smaller firms who are on the platform and become Superstars is a little bit more of a tricky game, right? Because the platform can observe their growth. Right, can also know that they can become, you know, aggressive. They can all, you know, want a bigger portion of the value creation. Right, that's where the whole idea of this killer acquisitions comes, and that's where, you know, I would like to be careful. I am not in a position to comment clearly, what happens. There are people who've done these killer acquisitions, and they have much better understanding on this topic because it's a very complex topic. Because if a player becomes too strong, the platform has even the possibility of kicking them out, of shutting them down, and so it's in my I'm unable to offer you any kind of clear idea of what's going to happen if someone is on the platform and becomes a superstar. But that's much
probably switching from the opportunity to welcome a superstar on your platform to the threat of having a new superstar leaving your platform. So probably there is still a bargaining power, but it's a different kind of.
I see what you mean. Again, so if you were a superstar on the platform and if you leave, you're losing everything out. The platform is not losing a lot. It's only one player, right? So.
You're right.
And if you go somewhere else, it's very clear that you've lost out everything here because you've built your whole ecosystem on the platform and the consumers are not going to shift just for
you. You're right. If there's no more to homing, you're right. So the other question I was thinking about is that, when we think about these superstars, we think about, Beyoncé and individuals. The main point seems to be this ability to bring a lot of, consumers on the other side. Is there any possible way to get to that kind of power without being an individual? I'm thinking about, for example, the creation of sort of networks or unions of people, putting houses on Airbnb. So actually, the individual is really not a superstar. But if you put all of them together, you create a sort of union. You are increasing dramatically your bargaining power. Putting yourself in a similar situation.
I fully agree with you. If there are unions that are able to do that, and that's perfect. So that's the reason our paper doesn't, specifically say a superstar is being said. It can be anyone that is able to have bargaining power. Yeah, exactly. That is able to aggregate and bring aggregation, right? It can be that all the content providers come together and form a collective.
I think this is super interesting in terms of social impact. Yes. Of the existing mega platforms we've got today, so we see that more and more they are impacting many different aspects of our lives. It's not just a matter of buying something somewhere and have it delivered home. It is really impacting the cities, how they are, all the problems that we have especially in Europe, in downtowns which are not inhabited anymore because they are full of Airbnb. So I see a lot of implications of it. It's super interesting.
Yes, it is. It is. Yes, you're right.
When I'm reading platform papers, I cannot resist to put my perspective, and I mostly do research in the B2B environment on it. And in some case studies that I did in the past, for these B2B platforms, it was the case that you not only had superstars on the complementary, like on the provider side, but also on the demand side. So there can also be very, very dominant individual firms that demand, that build a superstar on the demand side. While there, when I thought about it, I thought that if you have, for example, a Beyoncé on Spotify, or a similar superstar that provides especially digital goods, then it is a one-to-N relationship. And Beyoncé or Beyoncé's content is not constrained in any way by being consumed by an extremely high number of individuals on the demand side. While if you have a big firm on the demand side on a platform, although theoretically it is very, very attractive for a high number of individual providers of services and goods, typically the firm on the demand side of the platform is only buying from individual providers of services and products. So it's not the case that comparable to I offer a digital good on a platform, it can be consumed by a variety of different individuals. If I'm there to consume, although it can be a lot that I consume per interaction, the number of interactions is typically smaller because when I go there as a consumer on the platform, I look for individual kind of interactions instead of like just throwing out my demand and then whoever wants to fulfill it. So I see there a similarity when it comes to the negotiation power and how this relationship between the platform and the superstar changes vis-a-vis kind of typical actors on the demand side. But I don't see it so impactful as it is on the supply side with a superstar. How's your take of that? Have you ever thought about it?
So actually, that's a very good point. You know, kind of if you have a firm that has a large mass of consumers that are, you know, kind of locked in, it can also behave like a superstar, right? as that's what you say. So very often we assume that consumers enjoy, when we talk on network effects, they enjoy utility from the presence of a variety, right? While you're talking that, you know, that the demand actually wants only one, that means there's competition between the suppliers, right? So again, we can also see large number of suppliers as a way of saying that there's, you know, kind of as competition, right? If there's more competition, the price is going to fall, consumers are going to be better off. So consumers might actually, the firm that has locked in consumers might want to go to a platform that kind of has many suppliers and it can, you know, opportunistically bargain between them to get the best price. Right. But you're right. It's not exactly the same because at the end, only one of them wins the contract. Right. And one of them is consumed. But suppose if they have capacity constraints. Right. So then there's going to be a set of 10, 15 different people who can supply. And then you want more people to be there. Yes. More suppliers. Yes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Super, super interesting. What one more thing that I thought about. And there I thought about the case, I think it's also quite prominent, Apple building Apple Maps, while in the beginning they were relying on Google Maps on the phone. So they had this one very, very strong, I think back in the days, it was comparable to a superstar complementer having this Maps app on a phone. And for whatever reason, Apple decided that's not even enough. They need to build this as a first party application. Is there, in your opinion, or based on maybe even based on data, some kind of mechanism to figure out when it's not even enough to have or if the bargaining power of the superstar complementer gets too strong? That's probably the right way to think about it. What's your take on that?
You're completely right, actually. Exactly what Apple did. Apple realized it was too dependent. All its consumers were dependent on Maps. And if suddenly if Google left their ecosystem, they would lose a large portion. So they realized that they had to find other ways to also keep their bargaining position. Actually, we had a paper on... we had so many extensions in the paper, Ben. You know, I cannot describe it to you. And we had to cut it down because some journals complained. They rejected the paper purely based on paper being too big. So one of the extensions was multiple superstars, right? And that order already you can see that when you have multiple superstars, then the bargaining power of each superstar is going to fall. Even though they're not directly competing, they're competing because what happens is in contracting, what matters is that you look at how much are you bringing on the margin, extensive margin. Right? How much are you bringing, given that the one of the superstars already accepted the contract? Then as a result, you only bring tiny portions. So again, here, suppose one of the superstars was merged. So for example, Apple and Maps and Apple were merged, like, you know, this vertical entity. They're already bringing a large enough demand. Now the superstar's value is only a small portion. If Maps was not there, then Google Maps would have been bringing a large portion of demand. Right? So their bargaining position shrinks. And that's one of the reasons why I think Apple did it, because it was afraid that its ecosystem consumers were too dependent on Google Maps and Google ecosystem. They didn't want to get caught into that quagmire.
And I think this is a super nice point on platform, because in a certain way, you're asking your complementers to build the value that should be delivered through your platform. But at a certain point, the risk is that too much value is in their hands. And at a certain point, you can be eliminated. So they can move the user base on and in another place if they leave. So when you got something like that, what you need to do is to be sure that your ecosystem around you is profiting, is, you know, making having a lot of success, but not too much.
No, I agree. So, but one point I wanted to make that why it differs from other cases is that Google was a direct competitor to Apple, right? So it had its own competing ecosystem, right? So it had a clear outside option. In most platform markets, you don't have a credible outside option, right? You know what they call the winner takes it all, right? There's one player that dominates because of the value coming from aggregation, right? And then it's not easy to move consumers to the other one. But on Apple and Google, it is very easy, right? So that's why they had to do this. But that's a good point. Thank you. Yes.
I think that's also a great transition to the second topic that we have on the list for today, which is exactly the role of hosting rivals. And I would like to split this into two because your work there is particularly looking at traditional firms that decide to transform into a platform and then make a second decision to host rivals or not. So maybe if you can share a bit on your work, when should I, as a traditional firm, or what are my, let's say, decision criteria to transform or not, and then to host a rival or not?
Thank you. Yes. So let me start with the first question on... let me give you some characteristics of what happens when you transform. So, you know, I'm working with my co-authors, Marshall and Alstein, and, Sarvesh Bandhu. And Marshall and Alstein and Jeffrey Parker have had a very nice paper on value creation, which also, you know, kind of how you can open up your firm to third, party complementers to add value, right? So that's a very well-known concept. But one important element that comes along with, you know, opening up your traditional firm to third-party complementers is that you bring in risk, uncertainty, right? You bring in risks coming from the fact that, you know, if I open up, I don't know exactly the quality, how they'll impact my, my own investments, my own value proposition. And that brings in risks, right? So the benefits of opening up are that you are able to create more value, but you also open up yourself towards risk, right? So these are the two parts that managers must, you know, kind of balance out when deciding to kind of, you know, to become a platform, right? For example, for a firm like Lego, it's great to open up because they already have fixed parts. You can build on top of them. You can allow creators to do different things, right? But for a firm that makes medicines, right, it's better not to open up to third parties because there's no way to, the risks are too high, right? For toothpaste, you know, so somebody starts adding, you know, weed in your toothpaste or something, that it gets mess, you know, but that's the whole point. You know, people are trying to create variety and that's an issue. So you just have to find the right balance between risk and the value proposition that comes with creating a platform. Again, now remember, platforms, what they do is they allow you to have network effects. And network effects value a lot aggregation of demand. That's the whole point of winner takes it all, right? Now you have, so imagine there are multiple firms that are competing and one of the firms decides to become a platform, but now it also has risks and benefits from being a platform. While the other firm that's traditional, its value proposition has not changed. It's still going to be the same competitor because it is not transformed. Right now, a firm can decide to invite the rival onto it. When does it do so? Right, that's important to think. When the value of network effects is not very high, and investment risks are high enough. Right, in those two cases, you want to invite the rival. You want to create a greater number of you want to create aggregation by by inviting the rival, what you do is you also invite more number of third parties. Because now third parties see, oh, there's bigger demand. So more of them are going to enter the ecosystem. by entering the ecosystem, then you are able to create more transactions. Despite that, you have lower value of network effect, you have a greater volume of interactions. And then it might be actually profitable to transform and invite the value. When there's no uncertainty of transformation, then you don't invite the rival. You know, you invite the rival to kind of, you know, balance the fact that I might not get enough value from transforming. So if I invite the rival, at least the fact that my ecosystem is present and there's a greater volume of interactions, I might win. I might gain from it, despite having some risk. So if I don't have risks, I'm not going to invite. If I have intermediate risks, I will invite. If I have very large risks, I will not even transform. Right? So those are the three different parts that you can easily break down. Because in the intermediate region, you want to invite the rival because you want to benefit from increased interactions. And the volume of interactions substitute the loss in value coming from risks or lower network effects. So that's basically the idea here. So, and if we see that actually, for example, firms like Lego and others, they didn't invite any rivals onto their platform. While, you know, there's a very famous German firm, Klöckner, it invited rivals. Actually, there are multiple other firms that have invited rivals because they needed to convince the market that they're going to be big enough. How can they convince? By inviting rivals saying, see, we are going to have all of this demand. So please, you know, complimenters, please come and join our platform. And only then can we have the, you know, solve the chicken and egg problem and lead to positive flywheel of network effects. Yes. So that's what we, you know, kind of write down in our paper, or at least show in our paper, Mathematica. Yeah.
Again, I think this is incredibly interesting, but basically you are making a balance in between the benefits, which are connected to the network effects, and on the other side, the risks. So this is super typical, you know, balancing between risk and benefit. Still, listening to you, you put more, you seem to put more attention to the risk. There's like, my question is, the two things should be considered exactly on the same level. So you actually, you know, try to find the right trade-off in between the two of them, or somehow you start from the risk and given a certain amount of risk, then you start thinking about the network effect. So in a certain way, there is a hierarchical order in between the two things. So are based on the same start, on the same level, or this kind of hierarchical relationship?
So in a sense, it also substitutes. I want to be careful because the reason why I talked about risk is because it's much more intuitive to explain in terms of risk. For a given level of network effects, what happens? If your network effects are very high, you can always substitute by saying that, you know, there might be risks, but, you know, can. Oh, so if the risks are high and network effects are high, then you still might choose not to transform. But if network effects are high and risks are intermediate, you may transform and you won't invite the rival because, you know, you don't need the rival because the value of interactions are high enough that you will dominate. The problem comes is that when you have intermediate level network effects and sufficiently high enough risks. So what I described earlier was given a certain level of network effects, if I move along risk, it's more intuitive that way. Because now if I move in terms of two dimensions, it's a little bit more complex to explain, you know, But we can also go in the other direction if network effects are very high. And again, but risks matter. Yes, risks always matter. Otherwise, you have to look at both together. Yes, you're right. Yes. So, but generally, we can explain it more intuitively in the dimension that, you know, give for a certain sufficient level of network effects, how would you play around, right? You know, with risks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How would you transform? What would your decisions be? And why would you do so?
And might we say, as you say before, that one of the reasons to accept your rivals is because you are actually not able to, you got a capacity problem, so you're not able to cover the whole market. So we saw this case in Milan, for example, with car sharing. So we had many, many different actors interacting together. So they were more than happy to go on the same, so they were going on the same platform because in this way, they were able to give an answer to everybody in the city needing something because there is a density kind of economic effect. And nobody was able to provide that level of density alone. without investing too much. So the risk would have been too high. In order to, it was actually a sort of risk sharing effect.
Yes.
So we share it and we get to it.
This is exactly what we have here as well. By once you join in, actually we find that investments, both the investments adds value to each other, right? And that creates a co-opetition effect. We're able to show that, exactly. Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes.
One additional thing that I thought about is the perspective of the rival, right? So why should I, as a rival, join the platform of my rival, right? I see the point of sharing risk, but I also think that there is some, and I think you also mapped this out in your work, some necessary incentive mechanism needs to be in place. But I think it's often, that's what I see, more than an purely economical consideration for many firms, especially in firm-to-firm or B2B relationships. Coming back to that topic again and again, as I told you, what I see there are two interesting case studies that I looked into recently. Is one in the field of manufacturing, industrial manufacturing, where different firms came together and tried to build a platform together. So it was started by a very, very few number of firms, but they didn't just invite rivals, but they had them buy in and get equity in a collective endeavor. And then another one, which is quite recent, which is called Overture Foundation. It is in mapping. So it's a collective formed by Amazon, Meta, Microsoft, and TomTom originally. And the idea is to professionalize OpenStreetMap. So make OpenStreetMap, which is basically the Wikipedia of mapping, to make it easier to use for business use cases. And they just released the first data set because every company brings different data in and they want to release it so that everyone, not just in the foundation, but also beyond, can use it. And a piece that I read about it, and I thought that was super, super interesting, was that for this first set of data that they now released, the quality and the quantity is quite limited. But the author of the piece, and I don't remember who it was, said that probably it was the main cause or focus for this release was the signal for every involved firm that they have buy-in, right? That no one is just there as a free rider to benefit from the other companies bringing in their data, their complementers, their users, right? So there, I think this is as a comment, and a very, very interesting additional tweak. So coming from why should I join as a rival, and then like the spectrum of different incentives, maybe ultimately ending in becoming a co-owner of the platform. But this doesn't end the interesting and dynamics that happen between co-owners of this type of platform.
No, yes, I. This is a fantastic new, starting point, right? And lots of things are happening here. So first, let me start with the idea that, the question that you asked, why me as a firm would like to go and join, right? So that's a good point. So we try to actually understand what would the small firm do, right? Which is not transformed. Will it decide to create its own platform or join the rival? And we find that in a lot of cases, it is not profitable for the firm to transform into a platform. It would rather go, because by transforming, it also has the same problems, right? It may get benefit, but it also has risks involved, right? But by joining the platform, again, it joins only if the other rival firm, which has transformed into a platform, finds ways to commit. In our case, we show that in some cases that the transformed firm actually pays the rival to come, saying that I will be I'm going to pay you all the profits that you may or may gain or may lose as a way of showing that I trust you, as a way of me buying out in your gains, right? It's the same thing of co-ownership, but rather saying that I pay you, but please come So that's what Outokumpu, I think, you know, Klockner did. Klockner literally digitized all the, you know, all of everything for its direct rival, you know, documents for Outokumpu, which is quite expensive, apparently. And they did it just to invite the rival, saying that, see, I am actually there, you know, in your well-being because I need you as well. It's a co, mutually, you know, beneficial relationship, which is the same as, you know, coming together and buying up. We are all internalizing the benefits of, you know, each other by buying. It's literally buying partial ownerships in each other, in a way, right? Yeah. But this is very interesting. These are very interesting things. For example, with Marshall Weaver, we are still working on a paper on understanding when should firms form independent platforms, when should they form federated platforms, or when should they join an incumbent like Google, like especially in the German car industry. Because BMW and others, actually Sony has decided to create its own car with PlayStation instead. Which is you know, surprising for me, you know, but I think in the future it will be a norm. And these platforms are thinking how to create content for the car, right? And we have very nice results, but we still have to write up the paper. You know, it's in 80% done, but we have some nice results where we show that in some cases, when the risks are of transformation are not very, very high, you may actually, or they're, your luxury firms like BMW and, you know, top car brands may choose to form their own platform. And otherwise, they might go and form federated platforms away from the Google incumbent, because Google serves many other firms that are low quality firms. And by BMW and you know, Audi and others joining these firms, they add value to these low quality firms, right? They're through their involvement and presence on Google. So they have to be careful as to how to, you know, kind of organize themselves. And this is a very complex question, but we are trying to work on it, and let's see.
Yeah, one very interesting comment with another case. I don't know if are you familiar with HeyCar, the used car marketplace? It started as a joint venture by VW, Volkswagen, and Daimler. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to compete with, for example, AutoScout or these typical used car marketplaces that already have a platform. So they didn't want to join an existing one, but come together as like superstar complementers, mm-hmm. and build a competitive platform. And now, very, very recently, Daimler announced that they're going to, I think they already dropped out. So VW bought their stake. And I assume that they now think that it's time for them to build their own platform as a third one. So this could be an interesting case. Let's see what's coming up there. But yes. We already can say that they try to build their a competing platform in the market for used cars, where they could offer their own vehicles as two superstar complementers, and now one of them dropped out. So let's see how this unfolds. But
yes. There are lots of cool things happening with digital technology. Totally. We have a lot. Yes, you're right. This is, I wrote this down, this example. So I'm going to, you know, try to find ways to, you know, how to incorporate this in our paper.
I was thinking that we are talking about a super interesting topic, that is when to accept or not accept rivals and so on. But in a certain way, we are talking about, this is a kind of decision that normally is a problem for, yeah, let me say, an elite, very, very small part of a market. So these companies, which somehow are not natively digital, and they are traditional companies which understand that they can use platform, you know, mechanisms. And then the step number two is, okay, but when you do it, should you accept or not rivals and so on? So if we do one step back to the first decision, that is, you know, how to decide that you want to become a platform, to transform into a platform, because this is a super interesting topic to me, because my perception is that it's very, very, still very, very difficult for many companies to fully understand the benefit side of it. So the risk side is very clear. So you need to invest money, you need to get into something you don't know exactly, you need to connect in many cases with external providers. There is a very strong technological point of view. So many companies see platforms not as business models, but as, you know, technology. So you create your infrastructure and stuff like that. I'm curious, to the best of your understanding, in this moment, what is the biggest and more, you know, difficult to be overcome barrier for existing traditional companies, you know, which prevents them to embrace a sort of platform thinking way of doing?
Thank you. That's actually a very good point. You know, very often it's very hard for firms to understand what is the value proposition of the platform. As a traditional firm, they know clearly what the value proposition is. They know that they're selling a car, right? But it's very hard for them to envision, how can I make a car into a platform, right? And Sony has done it now. Sony has said, you know, Google is already doing it. Like with Google, you know, what are you, Android Car, I think, or Apple CarPlay. Literally, your car is going to become big giant TV, or a big giant phone, right? With app providers coming in. So if BMW and others are able to understand, or, you know, traditional firms are able to understand, how can you create or have the value, you know, proposition, what's the value proposition if you transform into a platform? That's very important, because it's giving away control of some of your value in favor of additional value coming from aggregation, right? And firms don't have this, you know, this is not there. I've not a thought of it. 10 years ago, I've not a thought of my car being a video game, right? Big PlayStation, you know, I sit in the PlayStation and go from one place to the other. Now I'm looking forward to it. I don't play video game, but more that, you know, self-driving car, I can read my papers, do my work, you know, I don't know, listen to music and not drive. So just trying to understand that your physical product is just a vehicle towards, you know, to interacting with a pun intended, you know, to a wider variety of, you know, different complementers. You just have to find what is the value proposition, how you can do it. And that's hard. But as technologies evolve, I think their use cases will come up. Now, because only now it's coming up because of 5G, right? Previously, there was no 5G. It was very hard for them to think of all of these things.
Very good. Shiva, it feels like we could talk for another hour or two, but I think we might need to postpone this to part two. So for today, we're almost at the end of the recording. But before you go, please share with us and with the listeners what you see on the kind of on the horizon in your own work, in the platform research work. What exciting projects you already mentioned? One exciting project that you have been working on with Marshall. But what else is there? What keeps you excited for the future?
Thank you, Philip. So, you know, I have fantastic co-authors, I must admit. And, you know, we've been doing a lot of exciting work. Recently, I finished a paper on, kind of platform design, where we show the price discrimination on platforms, second degree price discrimination. What is meant by that is that when platforms can charge different groups different fees, can lead to welfare improvement and actually Pareto improvement, which means every participant can be better off. And the intuition is so simple and so straightforward that, you know, I'm looking forward for the paper, you know, kind of to be, you know, going through the peer review process. Basically, if you can discriminate on one side, you want to increase the value of that side. How can you do so? By lowering the price to consumers. So let's say to the other side. And as soon as you do that, you kick a flywheel of positive network effects, and that leads to every participant being better off when the value is of network effects is high enough. So in a nutshell, this is what it says. But that's a very cool paper. And, you know, I have fantastic co-authors, you know, who I work with on that. I also have a very nice paper on GDPR. You know, the figure is just behind me. The most, you know, kind of paper that have come out till now say that GDPR has negative impacts on firms. Digital firms, while we say no, hold on, you know, the argument of the commission and others that GDPR actually provides more choice to consumers is true, because it allows more consumers to be more confident in digital kind of products, and more consumers are going to join the digital market. So now there's, for firms, there's a trade-off. You know, the GDPR leads to, you know, kind of demand expansion, more consumers come in, right? But what do you say? It also lowers the number of consumers who share data. And we can show that GDPR is good for firms that are that don't collect a lot of data, you know, because that way they can show trust in what they're providing, and they're not collecting data and they're not hurting consumers. While firms that are very large, like Facebook and others, it might actually hurt those firms. Or better way to put it, firms that collect a lot of data, and for those firms, it might actually hurt more GDPR. That's that. And this
which it is supposed to be, right? Which it is supposed.
Yeah, at least the fact that if consumers are given a choice, we should not neglect the fact that more consumers are going to start buying, man. And that's something that most empirical works have not looked at. They only looked at a certain point of time. They've not looked at the long-term evolution of GDPR.
Shiva, before we close, where can people follow your work, maybe reach out? Are you active on social media, X, or what's the best way to follow and get in touch?
I'm active on Twitter. I'm also active on my email, my website is there. You can always contact me, and as you did, and as I'm always very open to listening to ideas, and I would like to work on more stuff. And I got a lot of information. Thank you, guys. You've given me so much information on KCAR. I've written this down, and I plan to actually include it in our papers. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you so much, Shiva, for coming, for joining us. This was a great discussion. I also learned a ton. And let's stay in touch. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yes. So thank you also from my side. And I'm eager to read the paper about GDPR. I'm very curious about it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.